from 1973's Houses of the Holy. That's Led Zeppelin with No Quarter. Love that song. Always felt it had sort of a mystical cosmic vibe to it, and it fits, certainly it fits tonight's conversation with Dr. Ruth Kastner. As you have learned so far, she's a brilliant writer, scientist, and educator. I hope she's also a patient person who believes in her heart that there's no such thing as a dumb question, because I have a feeling I'm about to ask some that are on the verge of sounding very dumb. But it's, as I warned you in the beginning, it's kind of tough to get your head around this idea that reality isn't what it seems to be. And she's going to help us understand what she means, starting right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Ruth Kastner, there's a friend of mine named Jacques Vallée, who's been a guest on this program, a brilliant guy, astrophysicist, who's delves into some esoteric and colorful topics over the years on the program. He's listening tonight, I know, because he sent me a note. And you know the kinds of things that we cover on Coast to Coast. I think you're probably aware of it. So we often have people come on the program and talk about alternate realities, other dimensions, parallel universes, other higher dimensions, and exploring exotic ideas that there could be people out there somewhere. I don't want to pin you down with sort of UFO or alien stuff or any of that kind of thing that would make you uncomfortable, but I wonder if you could sort of walk us through the differences between our concepts, because we pretend here that we know what we're talking about, alternate universes, alternate dimensions, higher dimensions, that sort of thing. Which ones you think are reasonably possible out there, and which ones are not?
Well, in my interpretation, there are higher dimensions. You could call this hidden reality or this submerged portion of the iceberg a higher dimensional reality in a sense. Now, what populates that higher dimensional reality is quantum systems in my interpretation. So these wouldn't necessarily correspond to the kinds of ideas that you talk about on the show in terms of
People.
spirits
Yeah.
or people type, objects. But in terms of, there is room in this interpretation for the idea that the mind could live in some sense in this realm, in this higher dimensional realm. The mind could very well be an aspect of the quantum realm. So the fact that our bodies and our minds do seem like very different things, although some people want to kind of argue that the mind is just a phenomenon that comes out of the brain and out of the physical body, it certainly could be that the mind is distinct from the physical body and interacts with it in some sense. And in that case, it would be legitimate to think of the mind as inhabiting that higher dimensional realm of the quantum world.
And an alternate universe, that's something else entirely, right?
Well, an alternate universe is a little bit of a vague concept. You could think of this quantum realm as sort of an alternate universe if you wanted to. But the people mean so many different things by that I wouldn't really be able to comment very specifically on it.
Right. I was thinking about the bubbles. I have an image in my head of our universe as a bubble, and then there are other bubbles that bump into each other once in a while. Have you seen that model?
Yes, that's an aspect of the multiverse approach that deals with the cosmological question of at the initial expansion of our universe, it's conceivable that there could have been other sort of seed universes that expanded along with it. And that's a very different issue from the one I'm exploring. It's certainly possible, and I can't rule it out, but the quantum theory that describes our world of experience is directly related to that single world. So, in other words, if there were these other worlds, other sort of macroscopic worlds, then I believe they would probably have their own quantum realms too.
You mentioned in the book something that jumped out at me. You said your mind is a non-physical entity, and I think that the way you put it was that ideas, ideas exist, and they exist somewhere, but we don't really know where they are. It's not necessarily in the body, as you were just mentioning. They exist, but they're not necessarily space-time entities. Is that how you described it?
Right, and I guess that goes back to Descartes, who felt that there were two different, very different things that make up reality. One of them is the mental sort of substance that's non-material, and then the other is the material world, which we sort of identify with the objects we can touch and the objects we study with the physical sciences. But the mind, of course, there's a lot of controversy about this point, and there are certainly many physicists who think that, or who argue that, that the mind is just something that comes out of the physical brain, and that there's really no distinction between these two things. But I think if we look at our own experience, we certainly can think of ideas as very non-local sorts of things. I think most of us, we go, well, where do thoughts come from? Is a thought something I could point to? Can I say where it is? And we kind of can't do that. And I think that from that point of view, if you think of the mind as genuinely a non-material kind of thing, which is called dualism in philosophy, then the question arises, well, where do we put it? And I use this in the book to contrast, to actually have two different extremes, to illustrate the idea that the mind and ideas in the mind is one extreme of a very abstract sort of concept, whereas something you could look at on your desk, like a book or a lamp or a potted plant, is a very concrete, material, physical object. And I argue that the quantum systems are between those two extremes, that it's a new sort of aspect to reality that is not as abstract as just an idea in your mind, but it's certainly more abstract and less concrete than things you would see in your room.
Let's talk about consciousness for a couple of minutes. Some of the most entertaining exchanges on that email list have dealt with the issue of consciousness and what it is and how to measure it. And I wonder if you could sort of take a stab at it, whether or not we have a firm understanding of what it is. It seems like we don't.
No, we certainly don't. And the whole thing about consciousness, it's very ironic, I find, in discussions of physics. And a lot of people may think I'm very radical in my interpretation, but if you think about it, consciousness was brought in by people like Bohr, the early researchers in quantum theory, such as Bohr and von Neumann, because they couldn't figure out what gives you a determinate measurement outcome, what gives you this concrete outcome, when quantum theory just tells you you're going to have a whole bunch of different possibilities, but I'm not going to tell you which one. And they would say, well, it's consciousness that collapses the wave function, which is really kind of radical, and it's physicists bringing in a very non-physical concept. I mean, really, it's the realm of psychology, maybe philosophy of mind, and I'm not a philosopher of mind, so I don't really consider myself an authority at all on the notion of consciousness. So that's kind of my preface. But again, it's ironic that many physicists will kind of say, well, it's consciousness that collapses the wave function, as if they know what they're saying, but they don't, you know, because it's not a physicist is not someone who knows anything about the mind in that sense or consciousness. Maybe we could ask a psychologist who probably knew more about it than we do. So there's all this kind of hand waving, and another term for that is psychophysical parallelism, which is just a fancy term for saying, you know, we're bringing in psychology, but we don't really know how it links up to our physical systems, and we don't. And so what I'm doing is actually less radical than that. I'm just talking about quantum systems and giving an account of how I think their interactions can be explained in a physical way. And then if you want to talk about consciousness, then you're really addressing a very different problem. But the basic point I'm trying to make here is probably very confusing, that you don't have to bring in consciousness at all in order to solve certain problems, like the measurement problem, the problem of Schrodinger's cat. You don't need to bring in consciousness at all if you're working with this transactional picture. And it's only if you want to solve other problems, the so-called hard problem of consciousness, that then you have to start going, well, where do I fit consciousness into my interpretation? But that the basic message here is we need to kind of look at this whole issue of consciousness in a little more careful way and recognize that physics has no business per se talking about consciousness. And if you're talking about consciousness, you're getting into philosophy of physics, you're getting into psychology. And so myself, I hesitate to really make any sort of pronouncements in that area because I recognize that I'm not an authority on it.
Sure. Here's where I was heading, though, about consciousness and its connection to reality, if there is one. Does the, and you touch on this in the book, you do more than touch on it. You talk about it quite a bit as the nature of reality. Does the universe exist independent of consciousness if there's nobody here to observe it? It's as you note in the book, there's the old riddle about if a tree falls in the forest, no one's around to hear it, doesn't make a sound. I mean, that's there's a much broader question. Is the universe here for our observation, or is it the other way around?
Well, what I argue is that when you're talking about human observers, people, entities that we recognize as having perceptual ability, I argue that we don't need those kinds of creatures. I include animals because I'm an animal lover and I think they have consciousness too. But we don't need to invoke a conscious observer in order to say, yes, there really is a world, there really are space-time events, there really are things happening. So I'm sort of saying I am not an idealist in that sense. I'm not saying I would, in other words, as far as the tree falling in the forest, yeah, I would say that if a tree falls in the forest, it really did, and it really created some sound waves, whether there's a person there or not. But then the issue of consciousness comes in when people try to say, well, where did consciousness come from, or how do you explain it? And that's what the hard problem of consciousness is. But as to your question, no, we don't need a human observer to say that something has really happened and that there is a concrete fact of the matter.
Some pretty interesting work going on in that area about how the act of observing seems to affect particles and reality. Or am I overstating that?
Well, here's where we need to distinguish between observation and the physical process in which energy and other quantities are absorbed. And that's what the transactional interpretation is about, and that's what helps it solve these puzzles, that you don't have to say, well, I just made an observation and stuff happened. You can say, well, what was it about the observation that you made that physically brought about specific things and specifically caused certain things to happen? And that's why I say you don't need to have people. You don't need to have people called observers. You need to have physical objects that are absorbers. And it is actually those physical objects, and they're really just atoms that can do this. Atoms and molecules can do this emitting of quantum systems, what I call offer waves, and what John Kramer in his original theory, his original interpretation called offer waves. That's what the quantum system is. It's an offer that's emitted. And then an absorber responds to that, and it is that response that gives rise to these space-time events. So in that sense, there's really something physical going on. And of course, as observers, we are made of absorbers, and we work with laboratory instruments that are physically made of absorbers, and that's why observation helps make things happen. It's not some magic consciousness thing. It's real physical processes happening.
Well, TI, transactional interpretation, that's sort of the heart of what you express in the book. And it's also at the heart of that debate that I mentioned that's been going on online. Are you considered radical in your approach to TI? And is that the part that's hardest for the classical physicist guys to swallow?
Well, I think they do consider my approach radical in that I acknowledge that quantum systems are not space-time objects, because that, again, requires that we allow the idea that space-time is not the whole of reality. But the transactional interpretation has been historically kind of neglected because it also has this absorption process that involves, as you see in the book, negative energies. And that's commonly thought of as a kind of time-reversed process. And people are very hesitant to allow this idea of backward-in-time influences. And I interpret it a little bit differently because, again, I see these quantum processes as not processes that are happening in time, in space-time. They're happening beneath or beyond the space-time realm, and they give rise to space-time events. And that may seem even crazier to some people, you know. But but again, if you want to have parallel universes, that's a little bit crazy too. You can say, well, where are all these universes? What sort of realm do they live in? Certainly that realm must be bigger than space-time too. So we want to be careful of having double standards, you know, when we say, well, one person's approach is crazier than another's.
You have a section in the book, I forget which chapter it is, where you talk about flatland, a two-dimensional
right.
place, and then the three-dimensional place. And I can follow it for a while. What I can't follow it is that there are other dimensions and what things would look like. Getting a handle on that is pretty hard, isn't it? If you add a dimension, how we can envision and get our heads around it.
Well, yes, that's the whole problem. You can't picture it.
Yeah.
That's the scary thing. I mean, if you think of that Flatland parable, which I encourage your readers to check out, it's just a timeless, wonderful story. And if you try to put yourself in the position of this poor square who's stuck on a flat plane, and that's all he can experience, and very similarly, he thinks it's crazy to imagine that there's a third dimension, because he literally cannot point his hand in that direction. He can't see in that direction. For him, it doesn't exist because he can't see it. And we're in that same predicament. We can't see these other dimensions. But the Flatland parable is very convincing about telling you that if the math tells you there's a good reason to think that it's there, then it could be there, even though you can't visualize it.
I want to take one more stab at consciousness.
Sure.
You know, we don't exactly know what it is. We don't know how to measure it. It's not atoms. Whether or not it's energy or not, that'd be an interesting question. You make the point in your book about energy conservation. Energy does not disappear. So, you know, the real heart of it for people listening would be, if consciousness exists, does it go on independent of the body? Because that raises all kinds of existential questions, whether we go on.
Well, if you want to, this is certainly an option people can do if it makes sense to them that the quantum realm is a realm that, you know, given its abstractness and our inability to measure it in concrete terms and observe it directly, if you think of that as being a domain that where the mental realm could live and could exist, then you can associate consciousness with that domain. And that domain is always there, in a sense. It's a timeless realm, and it's always there underlying our space-time realm, because that's where you get these excitations that are the quantum systems, those possibilities that have the potential to bring about space-time events. So, and I'm not saying I don't want to push that myself, because it's not a necessary requirement in my interpretation, but it's certainly one that is harmonious with it, and that you can associate consciousness with that quantum level, that submerged level, and it's always there, in a sense. If you take that iceberg metaphor and you think of the ocean around that iceberg that the iceberg is submerged in, you could think of that as consciousness, the part of the ocean that it sort of embraces this submerged portion of the iceberg. It's always there, and that's the part, that's where the iceberg forms. So in that sense, you know, if people want to think about consciousness being always there, that's certainly harmonious with this interpretation.
Now you're talking. We're talking with Dr. Ruth Kastner about her amazing book, Understanding Our Unseen Reality. See, I told you she was going to help us understand this a little bit better. We'll continue our conversation after this, and we'll open up the phone lines in a bit so you can dive into this as well. Steve Miller, Space Cowboy, he's known by a lot of other nicknames, but under this one, he takes us into the break. That's British superstar singer Robbie Williams, who co-wrote that hit in 1997. It's called Old Before I Die. Robbie sent us an email 2 days ago. He's on tour in Greece, but he says he's spending some time between concert stops listening to Coast. We appreciate that. I told you Dr. Ruth Kastner was in good company when she said she was starting to get geeky on us mentioning an old episode of Star Trek. One of our listeners, Howard Legister, came to the rescue and says, just wanted to say that episode of Star Trek that was mentioned that featured Lieutenant Worf in multiple realities was from Star Trek Next Generation, Season 7, Episode 263. The episode is titled Parallels. I knew somebody would come up with it. We continue our conversation with Dr. Ruth Kastner right after this, talking about time, the nature of time and reality itself. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Ruth Kastner, one of the quotes I pulled out of the email chain, and there's got to be hundreds of them over the last couple of weeks, someone made their comment, Ruth is, quote, her work is using, quote, excess metaphysical baggage. I had to laugh at that. is there anything metaphysical about what you're saying? It does seem like some of this stuff sort of approaches the edge of the metaphysical.
Well, like I said at the very beginning, physics is at a point with quantum theory where you have to look at the theory and say, well, what is it telling us about reality? And if you look at the structure of the theory and you just read it off, and this is what the transactional interpretation does, it actually shows that the mathematical formalism of the theory is really talking about the processes that I've described. And it's really a matter of opinion, in a sense, what people think of as excess. There's certainly, the word metaphysics just simply means the realm of being that goes beyond what you can directly observe, and meta meaning beyond or above. And in fact, John Wheeler, as I mentioned earlier, has done this himself in talking about a great smoky dragon, and there's all kinds of extravagant, if you will, metaphysical statements in the physics literature where people are trying to interpret quantum theory. And in fact, as I mentioned earlier, with attempts to kind of salvage a classical worldview where you have more of a concrete picture of what's going on, in my view, this is really a lot like what Ptolemy was doing with trying to hold on to the Earth-centered picture of the solar system, and therefore having to kind of tinker with the theory and account for the retrograde motions of the planets, which in itself was really excess baggage. It was excess theoretical baggage, and it wasn't really true. It did not correctly describe the structure of the solar system. When we arrived at the sun-centered theory, we saw it was much simpler, and it made so much more sense. And when I say simpler, I mean straightforward in terms of the theory directly tells you about the reality that it's describing. And there are other approaches that try to inject objects and concepts into the theory that will account for, that will make there be something classical there, something that we can get our hands on and say, oh, it's really there, it's really in space-time. And to me, that's what the excess metaphysical baggage is.
There was a quote
not
in the book.
I
got you. There is a quote in the book, I forget who it was from, but it was something to the effect of, reality is being born right now. It never existed before right this moment. What does that mean?
Well, when I say reality, I'm not sure about the exact quote, but space-time events are being born out of this quantum realm. And the analogy I use there is kind of a knitting picture. Anyone who has ever seen anyone knit or maybe knitted themselves, seen your mother knit or your grandmother, you've got yarn and you've got these knitting needles. And the metaphor here, the picture here, is that the quantum processes and the quantum objects, things that are emitted and absorbed in my picture, are like the yarn. And the knitting needles represent the present. They represent what I'm talking about as the timeless realm that takes those quantum potentialities and turns them into concrete space-time events. And so you always have the knitting needles, they're always there, and you're always working on a particular row. And so in a sense that the row of stitches that's currently on the needle is this timeless realm of now, that we all experience the now. And this is something that's kind of tricky in physics. It's very hard to get a picture of, well, where does this now fit in? And what I like about this interpretation is it does provide a way to understand that, where the now is just the process of emission and absorption and creating space-time events out of these quantum possibilities.
We'll talk about time for a couple of minutes and perceptions of time. You mentioned in the book about how, you know, if we look at the sun, we're actually looking, in a way, back in time. We're seeing the sun as it looked 8 minutes ago.
Right.
This
particular interpretation says that when an atom emits a photon, what it's emitting is this possibility, and the possibility is actually a process that inhabits this realm that is not within space-time. And when a particular photon happens to be absorbed at our eye, there are absorbers in our eye. Again, it's not consciousness, it's this physical process that actually creates an event, an absorption event. That particular event is now like a stitch on the needle, and the emission of that photon is now like a row that just got extruded in the it's hard to do this without showing it to you,
Yes.
but if you look in the book, you see that there's a diagram of how the knitting actually gets extruded, and the knitting kind of falling away from the needle is the process of events coming into being, and you always have to have two events come into being, the emission event and the absorption event. So the sun emitting that photon is the emission event, and your eye absorbing it is the absorption event. And when that, what I call an actualized transaction occurs, that photon is now placed into space-time in the past, and it's placed in such a way that it's, you know, the 8 minutes or however long it took for that photon to get to your eye. So it's not literally, you're not literally looking back in time, but you are participating in a process that's actually kind of bringing about an event in the past through this transaction.
Most of us, when we're trying to wrap our heads around the idea of time, I mean, we consider that it flows in one direction. X happens and then Y happens. And I'm older in 2 minutes than I was 2 minutes before. And it always goes in that direction. But as you note in the book, I mean, it can flow. Even classic physics tells us that it can flow in both directions. And that's a tough one to get our head around, that time is not necessarily linear. What's that mean, though?
Well, actually, in the transactional interpretation, the way I'm presenting it, there's actually a good reason for why our sense of time only goes in one direction. Because even though the laws have this symmetry about them, that it looks like processes can go in either direction, that applies only to this potentiality, this quantum domain, this submerged part of the iceberg. So that kind of time reversibility of the laws really only occurs at the level of possibility. And when we get events actually created into space-time, placed into space-time, they really only move in that one direction. So it's just like the knitting. The knitting is proceeding in a very directed way. It's falling away from us, just as the past sort of falls away from us. And we really experience that. We experience that we're always where we are. You're always where you are, but you remember events as they fall away from you into the past. And you don't know what's in the future according to this interpretation because it's just possibilities. It doesn't exist yet. So this is where free will comes in, and this is where the opening in this interpretation that you can go, wait, my experience of the flow of events in one temporal direction, there's a good reason for that. There's a physical reason for that. And the time symmetry is more at the level of possibility than it is at the level of space-time events.
We'll come back to free will in a bit. I definitely want to dwell on that a little. The idea about time that you describe in the book, I mean, it opens up all kinds of great sci-fi premises that have been explored, the Terminator movies, sending somebody back in time. And I don't want to get quite that exotic, but some of your colleagues have written about, in a very real way, about the ability of the future to affect events now. And that's another tough one to sort of get our head around. But where do you stand on that stuff?
Well, where I stand, the future doesn't exist yet.
Uh-huh.
So you can't say future things are influencing the past. Now, you can say the future consists of possibilities, and possibilities certainly can contribute to what happens in the present and what happens in the past. But I think these other researchers are wrong, and I think they're making a mistake, and I think that they're kind of assuming that if you have the laws have time reversibility in them, because they don't acknowledge the idea that there could be something beyond space-time, that there could be a realm that actually gives rise to space-time. They think space-time is the whole story, so they naturally think that these laws directly describe space-time, and therefore they think that future events exist out there. And I just think that's a wrong reading, and it comes from not recognizing that you're assuming that when people do this, they're assuming that space-time is the whole story about physical reality. So in my book, the future just doesn't exist yet, and that's why we don't know what's going on in the future and we can't access it. It's because it's not really there.
I warned you at the top of this hour I might ask some dumb questions. Here comes one. You mentioned in your book you used The Matrix, the movie The Matrix, and the character of Neo to sort of make a point about the nature of reality. I want to take it a step further in that we've discussed it on other programs on Coast to Coast about the idea of manufactured reality. In the Matrix, of course, it was a massive computer network that was creating a reality and sticking it in the minds of living beings. Where are you on something like that, a manufactured reality? Reality is not quite real. It's created as it's an alien video game or a superior being of some sort that's just playing around.
Yeah, I can't rule that out. That's sort of Descartes' evil demon scenario. That's the creepy thing. We can never really rule that out, can we? I choose to be a little more hopeful and say that we have these quantum processes that seem to be described by our laws, and that's what's really going on. And it takes another level of kind of paranoia, if you will, to say, well, we got these quantum things happening, but there's really some demon puppet master contriving all this to deceive us. And I certainly can't rule it out, but once again, that's something you can never refute, but there's no point really worrying about it because,
Nothing you could do about
what
it
are you
anyway.
going to do? Right.
I thought another tool that you used in the book that was had me scratching my head is about the Alice in Wonderland and the Cheshire Cat. How, the Cheshire Cat disappears and all we see left is its smile. It's a great way to sort of express some of the ideas that you have, but I'm left asking, well, where is the rest of that cat? And I guess that's kind of a central question here.
Yes, once again, it's in that submerged part of the iceberg. And if we're just using our concepts and our tools of the ones we have while we're sitting in that ship on top of the water, and we're looking at the things we can see from that vantage point, it's hard to really see where is the rest of the cat? Where is all this stuff going on? I can't see it. But the theory's telling us about it. And this really kind of reminds me of the success of Boltzmann, who was this brilliant physicist from a couple hundred years ago, who first came up with the idea of, hey, there might be atoms happening here. That might be why we get thermodynamics, and might be why we get these phenomena that we see in the macroscopic world. And people just laughed at him. I mean, they really gave him a hard time, and he actually ended up committing suicide. But he couldn't tell them where are these atoms. They kept saying, well, why can't I see them? Where are they? He said, they're unobservable. But if you analyze their behavior according to laws that we think we have confidence in, look, they give you these phenomena that you can see. And to me, that's the power of physics, that if you think about unobservable things and they give you the right predictions, then that's good reason to think that they really exist, even though you can't directly see them.
You use a baseball analogy too, to sort of express that same point, I think. Can
And
you tell that
yes,
story?
well, the baseball is this nice classical object that we can all see very well, and it's a macroscopic object. But if we were to zoom in on it and keep zooming with the most powerful microscope we possibly could use, at its fundamental levels, it is comprised of these quantum possibilities. And the reason we see the baseball as concrete is, again, this process of actualizing events, energy being transferred from emitters to absorbers, and those constituents in the baseball that are reflecting light, that are reflecting photon offer waves, if you will, coming from the sun and then bouncing off, interacting, scattering from the constituents in the baseball, and finally being absorbed by our eye, that create all these space-time events that allow us to say there's something happening here, and I'm calling it a baseball. And then someone else, across the stadium is going to have a similar experience. They're going to see a different side of the baseball. But because we can corroborate all these experiences, we say, well, there's a baseball really there. And in a sense, it is, but it's just this collection of events in space-time that are supported by the quantum level that we can't see.
I had written down on my notes, and I'm not sure if I'm quoting you or paraphrasing this, or you were quoting somebody else, but it's the idea that time can exist without space, but space can't exist without time. What's that mean?
Well, you can have, if you look at an object and say a photon being emitted, or not a photon, we need an object with some rest mass, or take an electron or something like that, an electron being emitted and absorbed, we can define what's called its rest frame, in which it's not moving, and it's as if it just kind of got emitted, it like dropped off by one bus and then picked up by another bus. And from its standpoint, it didn't go anywhere. So it did not traverse any space from its vantage point, but it did have to traverse time. And so in that sense, whenever you have a what I call a transaction, whenever you have an emission and an absorption of a quantum that has energy, it at least has to have energy. It can have zero momentum, meaning it has no motion, but it always has to have energy if it has any rest mass, like an electron. And so in that sense, you can create an interval of space, of time, excuse me, you can create an interval of time without creating any space. But whenever you have momentum, you're creating space in this interpretation, but you're also creating time. So that's, in a sense, what I'm arguing here is that time, space and time really are fundamentally different.
Well, I didn't realize that there had been discussion that they might be the same. I didn't even, I don't know enough about them to realize that that had been a part of the debate somewhere along the line, that they might be the same thing.
Yes, this is actually an issue in many, some interpreters, particularly of time-symmetric approaches, people who want to say, you know, the future already exists and so on. They like to kind of play games with space-time and play with the idea of interchanging space and time. And they like to argue that because relativity theory tells us that space and time are definitely connected and they get intertwined in a certain sense, some people want to take that even farther and say that there's really no difference between the two. And I think that's wrong, and that's what I, the point of that argument is to say, well, they're really not the same. And this is part of arguing that our sense of the flow of time or our sense of change having this particular temporal direction is not an illusion, and that we should respect that and think that that's one of the things that physics should explain. Because there are a lot of people who want to say, no, that's just an illusion, and you're not really, there's really, our sense of the flow of time does not pertain to anything really out there in the world, and it's just some weird artifact of our nature as beings who move through time in some sense. But then, of course, they can't explain why we move through time or why we have that perception. So that's a whole other debate, but there are people who really think you can interchange the two.
Well, we move through time, but I got a feeling you're not going to be a big fan of time travel, not in a sci-fi sort of a way. You've already shot down my glorious idea that people in the future might be affecting things in the present. So you would not be a big proponent of the idea of time travel.
Well, not in the sense that I don't think there are concrete space-time people out there, but I do think there are real possibilities that comprise the future. And, you know, you can certainly entertain the idea that there could be entities that are of the nature of possibilities, and they could certainly, you know, and again, I'm getting off into the science fiction realm here, and this is not part of my, you know, don't quote me on this as far as a technical paper, but there are certain, the door is certainly open in my interpretation for different kinds of entities that are described by quantum possibilities. They're just not
right.
Space-time entities.
You'll see tomorrow that's the only thing that people quote you from this entire program. I'm kidding. We're talking with Dr. Ruth Kastner about her book, Understanding Our Unseen Reality. Some deep stuff here. A lot of fun. We're going to open up the phone lines and get your thoughts and comments and questions right after this on Coast to Coast. Blondie takes us into the break.